Welcome to the Shelf Shedding Movie Show. I'm your host, Jason Dubray. And for episode 120, I have my friend Carl Smith, who was on an episode where we looked at some crime movies quite a long time ago, and is back on for this episode, which will be on 70s crime. We're going to look at four movies in this episode, and looking forward to the discussion. And Carl is somebody who you've always had really kind of strong opinions, and I think that really works well for this show here. And I remember we did the show with Bugsy and The Killer and Animal Kingdom. We had a nice variety of films. I don't think there were any bad movies in that episode. So similar thing here, I think. But yeah, welcome back.
Yeah, it's nice to be here.
So, but I mean, I think you like crime movies, right? You like action types of films.
Oh, I love crime movies. They're one of my favorite kind of genre.
For me, I talk about on a regular basis, my favorite decade probably for cinema in general is the 1970s. And crime films in this particular decade were really good in a sense that the gloves were off, the censorship was off, so then they could bring the real blood, the real violence. The language could be a little bit stronger and could kind of move into a bit of a different territory, in a more modern territory, which of course led into the 1980s with the Die Hards and Lethal Weapons and all of those more genre pieces. But it seems like there's a little bit more of an edge, a little bit more of a realism to 70s crime films. There'll be one very famous filmmaker that we talk about here that I think might have been a bit more comfortable in an older era of cinema, but tried his hand late in his career at doing a bit of an edgier 70s based crime film. And so we'll kind of see how that goes. And we also have like some avant-garde stuff here. Like we have one filmmaker who, you know, created a story around this idea that he was just an amazing stunt driver and actually like went for, like, when you're seeing a car chase in this film, it's actually happening on the streets of Los Angeles. I'm of course alluding to Gone in 60 Seconds, not the Nicolas Cage one, but the original one there.
Thank God, not the Nicolas Cage one.
Yeah, it's that one. It's been a long time. I saw it in theaters. I haven't watched it in years. People really don't like that movie. I'd have to go back and watch it to see what the problem was. I was young and I remember I came out of that movie, was like wanting to drive fast. It was like one of those, you know, when you're late teens, early 20s, and this adrenaline rush of a movie. But as I recall, it wasn't that great. And it was a weird way to do a remake of this particular film once we get into this one. But yeah. So, I mean, there are so many crime films from the 70s, so this is going to be a very small sample of them. Do you have any kind of like things that you're looking for in a good crime film, or certainly a good crime film from that era?
Well, the one thing I like about crime movies is I'm really plot driven and character development. Those are the things I really look at.
And I would agree. I think 70s movies did a better job of that than action movies after that time. There are exceptions along the way, but they really do kind of, they had the patience in the 70s that they don't seem to have anymore to, you know, set up the situation. You get to know the characters before we actually get into the crime and the action and the car chase and the violence, which some modern moviegoers or fans don't like as much because they have to wait. They're wanting for that immediate action sequence that we would get in for lack of a better term, a Mission Impossible movie now or something along those lines.
Yeah, they want the adrenaline rush.
Yeah, versus a build-up to it is something that I've always appreciated. So when it happens, the impact is a lot stronger because you've been kind of sitting there and kind of waiting for it to happen and waiting for the danger to happen. And it doesn't always happen in the timeline that you expect as a typical moviegoer.
Yeah, I agree. Yes.
Yeah.
This first one on our list is Frenzy, correct?
Yeah. I'll just mention the four movies we're gonna watch then, and we could still keep a bit of a general discussion going. But yeah, Alfred Hitchcock, the one of the most famous filmmakers in the history of cinema, in the 1970s with Frenzy. Then we're gonna, after that, we'll review William Friedkin. Very like the 70s were his time as a filmmaker, a little bit more of the early 70s, but a film of his called Sorcerer. Then we're gonna take a look at a movie starring Robert Duvall, who we lost recently. I think it was after I pitched this show to you that he died right after that one. Kind of a forgotten crime movie called The Outfit. There's another movie, more modern movie called The Outfit, which is completely different with Mark Rylance. I could get that mixed up, but 1970s, early 70s film, The Outfit. And then, as I mentioned, we're going to take a look at Gone in 60 Seconds, the original Gone in 60 Seconds. Those are the four there. But sorry, I cut you off. What were you going to say about Frenzy?
I said the first one's going to be Frenzy, right? That's the one we're looking at first.
Yeah, that's the one we're going to look at first here. So, yeah, is there anything in general you want to say about 70s crime movies before we start reviewing?
One thing I noticed that kind of permitting through going through all of these movies is the cinematography. I think if they were remade now, I think the cinematography would be a lot better than what they were back then.
They don't look as polished.
Yes.
And I think
They're more
it's,
stark, more real almost.
yeah. And for me, I almost like that because it feels a little bit grittier. It's like you're observing something that's happening on the streets of Los Angeles or New York or London, in the case for one of these films, or in the Midwest, US. It's got a grainy quality and kind of a bit, again, more of that independent spirit that permeated through the 1970s. Remakes would be, 4K, IMAX, everything looking really, really crisp. And those the films like I don't know, I think you've watched Grindhouse, right? Like the Robert Rodriguez, Quentin Tarantino thing where they altered or digitally made the cinematography to look a little bit grainier or more like cinema with the different like cigarette burns at the side and that kind of thing there. This contemporary effort to make it look 70s, even though we can sort of see through that a little bit versus like the authentic 70s that we get from watching these movies. And depending on how you watch it too. I mean, if you watch this as a DVD or if you're watching on VHS, it gives you a completely different thing than an HD or a 4K version of these films. But a couple of them are pretty obscure. I mean, these there's a bit of a resurgence for Sorcerer, but I don't hear a lot of people talking about the other ones. Other than somebody like Quentin Tarantino, who's a big fan of 70s cinema, and Death Proof was heavily inspired by many racing films or car chase movies, including Gone in 60 Seconds there. So, anyway, thank you. Yeah, thanks for being on the show. And if we're ready to go, we're going to take a look at our first film.
I dare say you are wondering why I am floating around London like this. I am on the famous Thames River, investigating a murder. Rivers can be very sinister places, and in my new film, Frenzy, this river, you may say, was the scene of a very horrible murder.
It's a woman!
Another necktie murder.
Of course, one can never be sure where danger lurks. They tell me a dreadful crime was committed right in this building. My investigation next led me to this innocent alley, of which there are hundreds in London. But I don't think we should stay long. Something unpleasant is about to happen.
Thank you.
scene of another horrible murder. This is the famous London wholesale fruit and vegetable market, Covent Garden. Here you may buy the fruits of evil and the horrors of vegetables. I've heard of a leg of lamb, a leg of chicken, but never a leg of potatoes.
Here, what's wrong?
Look, she's wearing my tie. How'd you like my tie? How do you like it?
My God, the tie.
So with Frenzy.
Frenzy, yes.
Hitchcock is one of my favorites, actually, because he does go through a major plot development thing, but the screenplay was based on a 1966 novel?
Yeah.
Goodbye Piccadilly? Farewell Leicester? It was, I was impressed because it was 1966. And FBI profiling didn't come around until about 1972. So someone was ahead of their time. They were knowing what was going on because there's a lot of things that they're doing here with this serial killer where they're actually profiling. Is you're giving you it to him. I was really impressed with that. Like, the profile in the FBI didn't come out to the 70s. So this was based on his 1966 novel. Someone's way ahead of their time there. For example, he lives with his mother, the killer. Like, yeah. Gacy could be any one of these guys, you know, really.
Yeah.
You know, like, I was impressed with that. And the other thing I like about what they do with this is the foreshadowing. Mm-hmm. You know, in the beginning, they're talking about, these two cops are talking about Waters be soon clean of all society's evils, and they call him the necktie murderer, and then you see a guy putting on his tie right away. I was crazy about that. But
as far as like with Frenzy, those who don't know the plot, there is we start out and they're doing this big thing about they're cleaning up London and making it look better, and they're down to this, the first scene is this press conference down by the river, which kind of goes disastrously wrong. And if you look for the Hitchcock cameo, it happens. He's standing there among the crowd there. We get a couple shots of him. And then his body floats up, and it turns out to be this necktie murderer, which becomes a bit of a media sensation. And then we end up following kind of our main protagonist here, Richard, played by John Finch. And we're seeing all of the... He's got some anger problems, and there's some other things going along, which is leading us to think, okay, there is a good chance that this guy could be the necktie murderer. But of course, we know we're watching a Hitchcock movie, so there's got to be a lot more to it than that. And we see these various characters in his life, and I think it's, for me, it's a clever switch around when we kind of figure out who. And I don't always know if I want to spoil it completely, but some parts are tough to review otherwise. But there's a character that seems the opposite of what you would expect, and then we start to get more information. And one of it is very much that thing. And when you meet the mother piece, I couldn't help, because it's Hitchcock, of thinking of Psycho. I mean, he goes back. Hitchcock was always interested in like the psychosexual aspect of things, but he worked as much as he could, pushing the edges of the censors of the 50s and 60s with that. Here, I mean, they can have the nudity. They can, like, show all the violence. There's no real restrictions here. The question I have is, you know, is he as effective when he can then show everything as opposed to when he had to suggest or allude to it or kind of get close? The shower scene in Psycho, for example, was pushing the edges of nudity without kind of completely going over that line here. That's not a problem for Frenzy. Frenzy has all of what you would expect there. But as a director, does he seem as comfortable in this material as he does in The Birds or a Psycho film?
I think he's very comfortable with that. And he did use that where he didn't show everything either. But there was enough said that you knew it was going to happen. And one of the killings, he says, "You're my type of woman." That was enough to let everyone know.
Yeah,
it's gonna happen. He didn't even have to show it. You knew exactly what happened.
Yeah.
So he used that again. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
But all kinds of things, you know, where there are misconceptions, right? Has been seen leaving the cemetery, the murder scene of his wife, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
All kinds of things that are, you know, they're trying to mislead you, but like I said, you know, another Jack the Ripper, they referenced that too.
And I always love, there's always something, lots going on in a Hitchcock, like within the shot. I mean, he did a ton of storyboarding. It was very in his control. But we would regularly, and particularly the films, he started his career in London and he goes back to London late in his career with this film. There's a lot of extra side conversations like the one that you mentioned between random police officers or a couple people in the pub. And it'd be something like, okay, why is that in there or whatever? But, when you go back to watch it, there's a lot of purpose to those extra dialogues and those extra scenes and the colorful things kind of going on surrounding the main characters, which I've always thought is a very clever part of Hitchcock's identity as a director.
Yeah. I like the his buddy who helps him. The wife, I thought, was... very good.
That
would be a lot of wives back then, I think, would have that kind of reaction.
Yeah.
Well, it's nothing to do with the guy, you know. You could see that, I think. Yeah, I thought it was a very good movie, actually. I was really impressed with it.
A couple of interesting kind of character actors, there's the husband and wife, right? And the wife in there, who, you know, is kind of holding him for a night there. She was, the nanny from The Omen, Billy Whitelaw, it's her name. And her partner is the social worker from A Clockwork Orange, Clive Swift. And they're the ones who are helping. And so there's all these, actors that also, I'm a big fan of, the show Fawlty Towers.
Big time.
70s. And we had Bernard Crippen is Forsyth. He's the guy who owns the pub. He's a real jerk. And he, you know, he shows, I've the more cinema from that time, he was in a ton of stuff through those years there. So, again, if you kind of love 70s British television or film, you're going to spot some people that you've seen before in kind of different roles. But that sequence with her fighting off and then like that whole thing in the back of the truck and all the pieces of that, I mean, that was such a long, elaborate setup, but it was beautifully done. I mean, that's like the best of Hitchcock.
Yeah, I thought it was comic relief going there. It was pretty cool.
He had some fun with that stuff. So that was a really kind of cool thing. And then she comes into the diner after that.
I'm surprised that he didn't get into this whole thing where, you know, the serial killers are idolized.
Yeah, no.
There's a lot of later things about serial killers later come up with the same deal that, you know, they become idolized.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't do that at all.
That's why I wonder about like the modern Netflix shows, the Monster series. Menendez and they just had the one with Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Gainey. I think in some ways that brings all of that back, but does it kind of, it attracts viewers, but does it do a good enough job of, is it celebrating the serial killers and idolizing them or bring them down here? Like the male characters are in this film, even the ones who seem like they have it together, they are a mess. And don't know how to relate to women. And this seems to be a thing with Hitchcock. And I don't know if he himself had trouble relating with women. You hear stories about some things on his sets and you wonder if he maybe identifies with some of these characters a little bit more than we would like here. But
Sergeant's wife.
This
does all the cooking.
That was so funny. Like, yeah, she's doing all this French cooking and he's hungry all the time.
He's starving all the time. Yeah.
And she's figured out everything. Like she says, well, this doesn't make any sense. It wouldn't be this person or whatever. And she's the smartest character in the film too. I watched this years ago and I didn't remember it being as much of an ensemble. I certainly remember the kind of the main thing with the guy who looks like the obvious serial killer. And then the police are after him and he's having to run away from all this. But I didn't remember all of this other kind of fun stuff happening. And I remember that I used to see, maybe it was like at the video stores or places like that this poster scared me. Like it was, oh, it's Alfred Hitchcock. He's a horror director. By that time he was known as that. Oh, this looks like a really rough and tumble R-rated film. And it is a solid R, but there's a lot of laughs and fun. It isn't like going to leave you really kind of down and depressed, even though it is about a serial killer in London who does target women. And when we see, eventually see how the murders happen, it is very elaborate. It's ritualistic, and it's effective. Those scenes are very effective.
Yeah, that's what I thought. The whole serial killer thing rang true. I've done a lot of research, done a lot of reading about serial killers and whatnot, and a lot of this rang true, they were doing, which really surprised me, because if it was like 1966,
Yeah, when the book came out, and then we're into the 70s with this film. So it took a few years. This was, I believe, his second last film. I think his final film was Family Plot. Shirley MacLaine. There's an argument that out there that Hitchcock lost his edge a little bit towards the end, but I don't think it's true. I think he started off as a really interesting filmmaker in the 30s and kept through right to the 70s here with this. And I think Frenzy is one that doesn't get talked about, but is worth talking about. What was a weakness? What was something that you didn't care for with it?
I'm not sure because I really enjoyed the movie. There was a lot of things I really liked about it, and I think whatever was a little weak, I kind of overlooked because the other things were so strong. That's what I thought. That's what I thought. The things were so strong that I didn't really find a lot of weaknesses in this at all. Yeah.
I had a couple things, but they're really picky. I do think the music score, like he was known for, like Bernard Herrmann, when he did the music scores for Hitchcock, he'd moved past working with Hitchcock by this point, were always so great and very famous scores. I think the music here is a little bit too cheery, a little bit too playful. It was a little bit distracting at points for me. I think, there's some acting scenes and some bit towards the end with one of the actors and trying hard not to reveal the spoiler, but the actor who does play the killer, I think goes a bit too big towards the end of the film. There's a scene where there's, when he's going after our main character, Richard's ex-wife, I think is just overacted, a little bit overplayed in there. They're keeping it fairly realistic, I think. And even though it has kind of those kind of fun touches at the side there, in the comic relief, but I still think it's down to earth. And this felt like a lot of the psycho thrillers that you could criticize, where it goes all of a sudden somebody who's been perfectly normal on the surface, the entire thing goes super over the top, and like, oh, where did that come from? I think that this movie could be accused of that as well. The resolution goes on a little bit too long in this film, I think, but it's a really good movie. This is me being really, really picky with it.
I don't know about that. I thought, like, even the music, you know, misdirection in the music was also something I thought was, you know, part of that whole misdirection.
Yeah.
That's why I thought it was kind of good.
Yeah, that's fair. I just said, tonally, I think it kind of took me out of it more than, I'm not sure I want a standard score either, and that's not something Hitchcock was really, he wanted something that was interesting, I guess. So, but yeah, that was just something I noted early on, that the music in the first part was kind of a distracting me a little bit more than I thought it should have. But again, I there's no such thing as a perfect film. So even if I love a movie, I try to kind of come up with something that I, you know, need to pick away at there. But more good than bad in this one. I think it's a really good film, and more people should check out Frenzy.
I would say so too. I'm on that. I really liked the movie. I enjoyed it.
In 1971, William Friedkin directed The French Connection. It received 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture of the Year. In 1974, he directed The Exorcist. It made history. Since then, Friedkin has spent over 2 years in 5 countries on 3 continents creating his latest film, an unusual adventure into the realm of suspense. By their past, robbed of their future, trapped in a life that was also a death. 4 men take an incredible chance, face an impossible challenge, and risk the only thing they have left to lose.
So our second movie is Sorcerer, directed by William Friedkin, and a bunch of people, and we kind of see established in the early scenes why, that are stuck in South America, and they're kind of looking for a way out, and they get hired to do this pretty dangerous job, and we watch them go deeper and deeper into this impossible situation, and again, it has some religious overtones, and you know, they're very much this idea that their previous life that they were living in kind of a really good situation, but when they could not go back to their countries that they were from for various reasons, they're stuck in this purgatory, but to get out of this, they're going to have to go through hell through the rest of the film. And that's kind of the journey. And again, my little bit of my religious take on Sorcerer. William Friedkin had been enormous because of The Exorcist and The French Connection, two great movies, but he kept making great movies after this. And Sorcerer is one that kind of got lost in the mix. And right now there seems to be a big resurgence or reexamining of Sorcerer as being one of William Friedkin's best films. Roy Scheider, who was in The French Connection, is the American who was involved with this, who got involved in a bit of a situation that involved the mafia, and he needed to leave the country. And then we have various others who were involved in assassination attempts and that kind of thing. So it's a remake of a film called Wages of Fear.
1960.
Yeah, French film. And it was based on a novel just before that, too. I still haven't watched Wages of Fear. I hear it's fantastic and might arguably be better than Sorcerer, but I look forward to watching that at some point. But I've watched it twice. The weird thing was that right after William Friedkin died, the Broadway Theater here in Saskatoon, where we live, had a couple of nights of retrospective screenings of his work. I went, and I think I just went on the wrong night, like after a full day at work, and it was the second for that night, and watching Sorcerer, which I had never watched before, and I had trouble keeping awake. I was just kind of seated in dark theater, and my eyes were getting a little bit heavy. So I'm not sure I fully appreciated it the first time I saw it, and then watching it fully awake and doing notes and getting ready for the podcast, I was like, yeah, no, this is a great film, and I can understand why people are hyped about it. It's just wrong time, wrong day, wrong time of day. So that's maybe the only criticism or the big criticism I have for it is, it, like we mentioned with the 70s, a slow pace. There's a long buildup before we get to these rather amazing set pieces with trying to drive these trucks across these bridges and these landscape that are impossible with all of these other dangers that these guys have and the survival that they have. But this time, edge of my seat, fascinating, suspenseful film. So I'm a big fan of Sorcerer. How did you feel about it, Carl?
I thought it started out really well. I'm a Roy Scheider fan. Loved him. Love Roy Scheider. Everything he did, I liked.
Yeah.
And this was, once again, he was the shining part of the whole thing.
Yeah.
I thought it started out really, really strong. You know, it tried an old formula always works, like Seven Samurai or Magnificent Seven.
Yeah.
You show who's going to be the crew.
Yeah.
You go back and look at each of their stories, why they're there.
Yeah.
I think that's what a lot of filmmakers don't get these days. They don't go deep enough into it. And I thought it was one of the best things because it really showed the character's desperation.
Yes.
The backstories. And I thought that was really good. And once they got into the thing and everything like that, and I don't know, the film, like the characters, for me, was not a lot of defining qualities. Not a lot of redeeming qualities.
Not redeeming. No, they are not. These are not likable people.
The film, like the characters, not a lot of redeeming qualities.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I didn't like the film. I thought it was a little too slow. And how in the world did they come up with this? Oh, let's go to South America. I suppose that's where it was supposed to be. I have no idea.
Why it's in South America or what?
Yeah, I have no idea why they went there. You know, like, it just didn't make sense to me. Like, this whole suspension of disbelief. I know you want that in movies, but this was more disbelief.
I think in like this idea that like they had to get these fake passports and get out of the country or else they're dead. And this is like this place where, okay, it's like in Casablanca, for example, in that film, this kind of neutral zone where you can be there and, you know, nobody's going to ask many questions about who you are. You just do your thing and you just kind of continue living your life. Doesn't matter what you were before, but then it's like this particular section is like filled with ex-criminals, but they, you know, they, and they're still trying to kind of find a way to to get some money and find some way to get away and get out of this. But that's, you know, so I think that's where it's set. I mean, I think maybe Friedkin was, not having seen the original film, I'd have to check on that. But what if that was specifically for Sorcerer that they wanted to set this? He was interested in a hot location, a location where, you know, there could be some tricky things with survival. I could argue that there's a few pieces in here that if it was made now would not work well because of some stereotypes or some racial pieces there that would get filmmakers into trouble. But I also kind of like the idea. I mean, it this time around, it reminded me in some ways of Apocalypse Now, which is one of my favorite 1970s films. That there's these warnings, like don't go any further, don't keep on this journey. That they go through and they keep going on the journey. It's like the last stop before things become really, really bad for them. The other thing I do like about it, and I mean, I don't want to spoil all of it, but this is, you know, it seems like they're moving through this and they go through all of this. And then, you know, one of the characters is able to overcome all of the stuff that they have to endure and the death and the survival and all of the obstacles. And it looks like, oh, we're lined up for, you know, redemption and a bit of a happy ending. The last shot of this film is brilliant in that way. Like, I mean, it's like, okay, let's, such a bleak ending. And you think about, because these characters are just so, so terrible, do any of them deserve to, you know, to have redemption or to survive at the end of this? Or is what's, you know, they get what's coming to them. Like this act, each act that they did at the beginning is set up like, okay, for the rest of your life, you know, you have to get this karma or this comeuppance or this payback has to happen at some point. And for some of them, it happens earlier in this film. And for others, we're pretty much down to the last scene, but it has to happen. Otherwise, like, you know, it's not a thing where we're people who are make bad choices or are bad people can escape this. And that isn't really the case here. You can't escape the things that you've set up before.
There's no ascent from hell.
Yeah. Yeah. So even if you survive hell, they're still going to get you. And so,
yeah.
Because, you know, there's so many, I love that location of like the bar dance hall that they established early in the film when the deal happens. And then we go back to at the end. I love the set design and I love like the look of it. And I think it's very well filmed. Maybe like what you were mentioning about the cinematography is better now. I think maybe this is the best filmed of the four that we're talking about. Because like just of how things are set up and the locations and all of that working together. And just where freaking decides to place the camera at different times, including that last shot, really works well for me. But I know I'm playing a bit of defense for this film here.
They did a lot of that work at the beginning.
Yes.
To get through all these characters, and then the interactions between them was very weak. You know, there wasn't a lot of interaction between them. That was, you know, that was minimal, actually.
But they in many cases, like there's the one guy that nobody trusts or likes, right? Like they got the fedora and they don't like each other. Like they're just doing this so that they can get what they want, you know, get the money and be able to find their way out. That's all that they're interested in. They're not looking to make friends. They're not looking to connect in any way. And so any of the dialogue, you're right. There's lots of like kind of silent sections in here. It's just when they need to, work together as a team or collaborate to overcome an obstacle. And I mean that one situation with the trees, and then they have to get them through the trees, and that whole thing that didn't impress you that much. That whole sequence, that set piece.
That wasn't that bad, but like I said, it was just not enough interaction between the characters at all.
I mean,
But
yeah, and I think it's almost like those set pieces, and directorially, that's what's maybe the more interesting thing to him, what he's doing, versus like a Popeye Doyle and Roy Scheider. Like they had so much time together and so many dialogue sections, and there's a lot more talking in The French Connection or in The Exorcist. Of course, you're watching everything that happens with the little girl, the character development of the priest and all that. There's more conversations, more dialogue, versus this could, in some ways, could be a silent film in some ways.
yeah, I just thought there should have been more interaction, like you could have had more like oh, I don't know, a Reservoir Dog, with them interacting more. And they're very
It is a
interactive.
Reservoir Dogs type of a setup with this group of guys, and they're all criminals. They're all like not great people, and they're doing this thing that goes completely wrong in places. I'm not sure like Reservoir Dogs is as much of a feels like a the religious angle. Everything Friedkin did for a long time had a bit of a religious allegorical angle to it that Dogs doesn't really have as much, but it's the more of the you get all of these criminals together and nobody trusts each other, and then it's all goes sideways. It was that kind of thing, but it isn't a dialogue heavy movie, you're right. And for those who like a lot of dialogue, that might be a drawback for Sorcerer for sure.
That's why I think, things didn't really ring for me there, is that whole idea. You'd think that criminals have a lot in common with each other.
Well, do
They
these
don't.
criminals though, when and I love the opening, and Friedkin did this a lot. He did this with French Connection. We have the whole sequence at the beginning of The Exorcist before we even get to Georgetown and everything that happens with Linda Blair and that with Regan, where we see the four stories of these. And I mean, we're going from all kinds of different locations around the world. We're in Veracruz, and then we're in Jerusalem, then we go to Paris, and then we go to Elizabeth, New Jersey, and each of these great little one-off mini stories that are happening, which leads to these four having to escape their countries, like this assassination that happens, like the thing in Paris and with the business deal and all that. Like that takes a quite a bit of screen time at the beginning. And what I like that about that is I didn't know what was happening. Like we just go straight into that stuff, and then we have to piece it together later on. Okay, then when they're all together, it's like, oh, okay, they're all stuck together in this place, and then they're gonna get, this is how they're going to be connected to try to pull off this kind of military mission there.
I thought it was a weaker show
Do
than
you
my favorite.
like French Connection and some of those other ones, and Exorcist and To Live and Die in LA?
Oh yeah, but like I don't go by, oh, he's done all this other great work, this is good too. No, I go by each one.
I just think it's consistent with what he would do with
It's one of those, what
this
have you done for
journey
me
into
lately?
the journey into hell, because I mean that was the argument, is that late 70s on his career tanked a bit more, but he kind of had this great 1-2 punch, and then after that, I think like after this, To Live and Die in L.A. And I mean, I think there were other good ones kind of before the end of his career. He worked right up until the time he passed away there, but it seems like the work he did in the 70s was strong. I've heard some people say this is their favorite of his movies, and then I've heard some other people say no, this is one of his weakest films. And so I think it's a little bit in between there, but I think my first experience with this was more similar to your experience than my second time watching it. And I was looking at some kind of side things, and it was kind of some other things it reminded me of. But and Roy Scheider was good. It was he's the lead, he's the American. So I mean, predictably, like which one of these characters is going to be
The
slaughtered
last of
or attacked. Did you like that sequence, like driving through all that ice and with that blue cinematography and how that whole thing, and when he's shot and he's kind of going in and out of consciousness? What did you think of that section.
It didn't do much for me.
No, I thought it looked really good. I mean, it, after all this stuff had happened, it had a bit of a surreal feel to it in the third act there. But yeah, I mean, by that point, if the movie hasn't got you, then it's might be a little bit too late. Like that second act.
It was kind of like the purgatory part. Like
Yeah.
You know, that's what I thought it was. Anyway, it was like the purgatory, you know, kind of not quite there yet, but you're getting there.
Yeah. And versus like this is he's almost trying to find his way out and he thinks he's out of there, but no, really it's not he's not out of hell. All right. Yeah, I mean Sorcerer, again, if you've never heard of it or you haven't seen it before and you're a fan of William Friedkin and you're a completist with this particular director or Roy Scheider, you want to see something, if you watch Jaws and maybe French Connection, some of his other
All That Jazz,
some of his more famous roles. I think this actually came out the same year as All That Jazz. He was a pretty, you know, he was like a DiCaprio of the 1970s. He was in a lot of really prominent films.
Marathon Man is fantastic. I liked his work in Marathon Man.
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
No, he's I loved him in Marathon Man. I was great in that.
I just think he was an asset. Like you'd see him in later films. Like I think he was in Malice with Alec Baldwin and Nicole Kidman. And, you know, just a great actor. I did, but somehow I still think he didn't completely get his due as one of the great actors of the 70s. But for those who like his work, check this out just as another level or him, you know, taking a risk. I think this was a fairly expensive movie to make too, and it didn't make a lot of money back. And I think that was also part of the, you know, some of the thought that this wasn't that great a movie when we were starting to move into that Jaws world and Star Wars, where you have to make millions and millions of dollars to be successful, which led into the cinema that we're in now. But yeah. Anyway, so I guess it'd be a thumb up for me for Sorcerer, thumb down for you, and that's
Didn't do it for me. It had moments, but not enough.
MGM presents an entirely different view of the world of crime. The story of two tough men and their struggle for survival against the largest criminal corporation in America, the Outfit.
Put your hands flat on the table.
Who are you, friend?
Macklin.
You hit a bank. You and your brother and a guy called Cody. Before your stretch, Midwest National in Wichita.
Right.
The Outfit owns it. So you know how it is. You hit us. We hit you.
The Outfit controls business, politics, police. It affects the lives of all of us. And Robert Duvall is Earl Macklin. He's being compared to Bogart and Cagney. Joe Don Baker is Jack Cody. Together, they're one of the most powerful teams in motion picture history.
Shut up!
You and your damn gun.
Don't ever touch this gun again.
Hard guy. I think you're Dillinger. You're nothing but a damned independent, a heist guy. You got no operation.
Soft hands behind you.
Macklin and Cody, independent professionals who've got the guts to fight back. You will never see a more exciting story of two tough men against overwhelming odds.
The good guys always win.
The Outfit.
A few years ago, I got a book, and it was a book on some of like Tarantino's favorite movies of, you know, different years in cinema. And one of them was mentioned that I had never heard of is The Outfit. And I was doing a little bit of a separate, I always have these movie challenges going, set a movie challenge for myself to watch some of these ones that I haven't heard of or haven't seen. And that's how I, the first time I saw The Outfit, and then I put it in for one of the shows, and I thought it would be kind of a cool one to talk about for 70s crime films, because I just don't think many people know that this movie exists. It's directed by John Flynn. It's based on a novel by Richard Stark as well. And Robert Duvall is playing Earl Macklin, and he's this bank robber, and he gets released from prison, but he had inadvertently robbed the outfit. So if you can kind of think of like the Kansas City mob type of idea, and as a result of that, there's a mark on his back, and also anybody who is connected to him, and he's a pretty gutsy guy, and he's going to go in there and he's going to try to get whatever money he's owed, and he's not really afraid, and he goes on a little bit of a revenge mission. He brings along his friend Cody, played by the great Joe Don Baker.
Love Joe Don Baker.
He's terrific. And he's one of the MVPs of this film. And then Karen Black, who is his girlfriend too, but she's the one who kind of got, into some trouble before.
Yeah.
Well, this revenge stuff goes back to the fact that like we just see this random scene where it looks like a lowly farmer gets murdered. Well, that lowly farmer is his brother. And he's going to get revenge for his brother no matter what. And it's just a really great role for Robert Duvall, he's been in a lot of stuff. I've never felt that he's completely convincing as a tough guy. Like he does look like the conciliary from The Godfather, or he's a preacher, or like the Southern, or a lawyer. He played a lot of lawyers. He played some cops and that kind of thing. But as being like the type of tough guy here, but there's something in here where it's just his confidence that he goes into any situation. He's smart. He's prepared. He knows how to get out of bad situations, and we watch him do it. And it's just a pleasure to kind of watch how this works. I really, really like this movie. I'd like more people to check it out. I think there might be a couple bits towards the end, particularly the last scene, which are a little bit of a step back from how this movie is very, very good. That could be great. But I was a fan of the outfit. And again, 70s movie that builds up to it, takes its time, looks very independent, looks kind of like down to earth for the time that it existed, but I think is a quite an effective crime film. So that's my take on it. Carl, what do you think of the outfit?
Well, how many times has the outfit been the bad guy in the 70s? Yeah. You know, like really, the outfit.
Yeah.
Who runs the outfit? You never know. Things like that. What's the origins of the outfit? You never know. It's just the outfit.
Yes.
And I like that. Yeah. I think it's pretty cool. But Joe Don Baker. Oh wow, one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Ludwig Walking Tall.
Yes, very good in that movie. That's
the original,
right.
The original. And then you saw the Rock try and just blew it. Where Jordan Baker.
Fantastic.
He also played the Wama in The Natural.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
I first remember him as that private investigator in Cape Fear, the 91 Cape Fear.
Yeah.
That was the first time I saw him, and then I would see him in all this other stuff. I didn't realize he was like the tough guy 70s actor to go for these types of films. And brilliant, brilliant actor. And he's great here.
Yeah. I like Duvall's been one of my favorites. Of all those, that third knockover was very well planned.
Yes.
When they started doing the knockovers, and they started robbing people. I think that third knockover is very well planned.
Yeah.
And Duvall, I remember comparing his interpretation of something like that with Payback with Mel Gibson.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Val Resnick betrays him so he can pay back the outfit and join them. That's that whole idea of the outfit again, right?
Yeah.
And I kept looking at comparing Duvall to Gibson, and I favor Duvall by a long shot.
Yeah, I think, and I'm a Mel Gibson fan, and I know he's got all his problems and stuff there, and he got kind of not completely canceled, but mostly canceled by Hollywood. But that was a well that Mel Gibson went to over and over and over again, like the revenge hero. Whereas Duvall had such a like wide range of roles in his career that, you know, it wasn't like, oh, here's Robert Duvall, so we're on another revenge tragedy or revenge thriller. And yeah, it's very subtle what he does. Like it's always kind of in the subtext, in the facial expression.
Yeah.
He could get mad. He could raise his voice. He could do all the things that anybody else could, but that wasn't like building up to that. It wasn't like going into some sort of a rage type of a thing in each scene. He's got the situation. He is figuring out how to approach it. He has a good backup plan and a backup plan behind the backup plans, as a great bank robber would, and the bank robbers would see in great films. So he knows the dangers of any of these situations he's getting into, going in to get the money out of the safe, or, you know, in that kind of that bar, that restaurant, and that there's, you know, the cook has a shotgun there, and then they have to be kind of ready for that in that scene. But like going in to talk to the bosses, or going into that poker game and figuring his way in and out of that, and holding somebody hostage. Like these are all just great set pieces, and just I love watching intelligent criminals in a film. Yeah. That's what really sets apart a great crime film from a one that's just wham bam action without any brains to it.
Yeah, I thought his calm quietness there was actually scary.
Yes.
You know, I thought that was the scary part, I thought.
Yeah.
Him being so calm and so, you know, that would have scared the shit out of people, yeah. I think.
And this isn't grandfather or father figure Robert Duvall at all. I mean, he's, you know, like his frustration with Kieran Black at the beginning is very strong. And like with that, you know, assassination attempt at the very beginning of the film early on too. And all of those pieces are really strong. They go into they go into that with like the two brothers, and the one guy was such a hothead, you know, with Joe Don Baker, and then the one woman's trying to seduce Joe Don Baker, and it's not happening, and then she claims a rape, and then they just believe it, and then they have to get out of that situation. Like each of those scenes is just a great mini movie on its own.
Yeah, I thought Joe Don Baker, he dies, is even dies like Malvolio. Little humor to his death, you know.
It does. Yeah.
That's what I thought. Little humor to his death. That's what I thought. You know, it's not as big as a house. You know, that kind of. He said something like that. Pretty similar. I thought it was pretty good.
Now we're speaking very positively about this movie. Here's an initial question I had about the premise, right? Like, this is the outfit, right? They probably have people everywhere. So if they're so mad at, like, if they're wanting to get rid of Earl, why didn't they get rid of him in prison?
Yeah, you figured they would have had some sort of...
Yeah, like, I don't understand why, okay, now that he's out of prison, that he's fair game. I mean, I don't know. Like, I don't think it was unheard of people getting killed in prison long before this. I think the other thing, like Karen Black, like she appeared in everything late 60s, early 70s, and, you know, Five Easy Pieces is, you know, in Nashville and movies like that. She does kind of disappear from the movie at points and then comes back in, you know. She was so crucial to the beginning. And I mean, it's not, and then Nora, this time was there like always great roles for women, but I'm not sure. It had the promise like it would be a good role for her, but I'm not sure that it was a great role for her, that she's basically the girlfriend or whatever, like she gets the outfit uses her. Yeah. What are your thoughts on that? Was that a bit of a weakness in the film, or did that seem about right?
Yeah. She was in there just to, I don't know. Definitely wasn't the Bonnie and Clyde. It was definitely
not
strong Bonnie at all. She was like,
they kept questioning why do you have to bring her along? Like, Just leave her behind or whatever. He doesn't want to get rid of her or abandon her, but I mean, puts her to some dangerous situations, and I'm not sure she's always that character's up to it.
Well, I don't know. I thought she was up to it when she.
Well, yeah, she got there.
When she got there, I thought she was up to it.
She didn't get there.
That's what I thought. I thought she saved her ass, and that's why I was surprised that there wasn't much lots to her in that whole movie.
She's another one that I've just loved seeing her in. Like those three leads are excellent. I mean, I could watch them in anything, and I still have many movies that I need to see. Duvall worked so much, and so did Joe Don Baker. And I just want to keep watching movies. But this one is a real hidden gem. I'm not sure. I know it was a tough one to get a hold of, and we were kind of back and forth in ways that you could see the film.
Nick, I thought it was, like I said, you know, I could see what in Payback, I could see what Gibson was trying to go for.
Yeah.
I don't think he accomplished it, but I can see what he was trying to go for, because that was, you know, I thought that reminded me the most of it. And like I said, Baker and Duvall worked together too in The Natural, right?
That's right, yeah.
Duvall was a Max Mercy character, wasn't he? The reporter? Yeah, he was the reporter in it, yeah. So they worked before, and I thought, well, I wonder if I've seen these guys before. And then I remembered, yeah, wait a second, yeah, it was The Natural.
And I think this movie came out in 73, so it was right between the two Godfather films. So, I mean, Duvall, I mean, his first film role was Boo Radley in To Kill a Mockingbird. But I think, you know, he was around, but The Godfather was a big jump for him in prominence, and he maybe filmed this before The Godfather came out. So this movie came out, and then after that, Godfather 2 and onward with The Conversation and Apocalypse Now, and like just so many great films through the decades. But they were probably fortunate to have him as a lead. And I mean, he was people, you know, because this felt like much lower budget than some of the other films he took on later on in his career. So,
yeah, the other was a big thumbs up for me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm glad because it was a tough one to get a hold of, but I think it was good. I think for me, I would have liked maybe just something a little bit more at the end. Like we get to, you know, it's quite a spectacular climax, and then what happens in the last scene and this getaway, but it just stops. It almost goes to a freeze frame and then credits. And I felt like we just needed one more, not a long scene, but one more kind of short scene after that. It was just like, okay, we built up to this. This has happened. It's done. Maybe it's showing restraint. Maybe some people say, oh, no, it's fine. Like once you're through with the story, just end it right then and there. But I thought it felt a little bit more abrupt. And that was my, I guess, and that question about why the outfit couldn't get him in prison at, like before the movie even starts. But if I ask that question, then we don't have a movie, right? So those were kind of the only two kind of major points there that I had against it. But yeah, I think I'd like people to seek out, and I'd love for one of these. We have all those boutique Blu-ray labels and that kind of thing. Somebody to come up with a serious release of this film, because it's a bit of an undiscovered gem of early 70s. And with the death of Robert Duvall, I think people would be, you know, very interested in finding the movies that were not his most famous, as well as celebrating his most famous works. Good enough on the outfit?
Yep, you bet.
Attention all units. The suspect's vehicle is a 1973 Mustang, yellow in color. The reason for pursuit unknown.
Get your hands on the windshield and don't move!
original Gone in 60 Seconds, it says in the credits, directed by Toby. Now, Toby is also H.B. Halicki. And he's essentially a stunt driver. And he basically sets up this whole thing with a team of people who go around Los Angeles stealing fancy cars and then selling them back or selling for parts. And then we watch this major plan for this like one day spree of stealing all of these cars, which goes a little bit sideways. And then we watch the most epic car chase you could ever possibly imagine from one end of Los Angeles to the other. There's some stuff surrounding it for sure to try to form it into a bit of a story. But really is this movie's excuse for one of the most elaborate car chases and actual car chases in cinematic history, involving their actual police officers and people in the streets. And I mean, parts of it are incredibly dangerous. Shot really well. I mean, there's scenes with media and different stuff happening in there. I'd say for me, the first time I saw it, I had trouble getting through it, which was kind of strange. Because it just kind of kept going. And I found the setup to be a little bit weak. But upon revisiting it and watching it this time, it went up in my esteem. And I kind of got to understand why those who are gearheads or those who like action movies are such a fan of this version of Gone in 60 Seconds. Because of like what is achieved here in the film. Because it is quite spectacular with everything involving that. I do think still the setup has some points where we have a lot of voiceover narration of dialogue and characters talking, which I know was done in post-production to try to make the story make sense. So that's how they kind of had to make that work, because they had all of these other scenes that they had to shoot on real streets and do the real stealing of cars to make that work. But I think all of like the real stuff they did is spectacular. And now they do so much stuff to take away from the stunt people's role at a time when they're going to introduce the Stunt Academy Award, which is kind of funny. We're in such an age of CGI and special effects and making sure that we don't put people in harm. It's nice to see movies like this where everything is as real as they can possibly make it. So my thumb is up for all of these, but I guess I'm a little bit less engaged in the story, but I am totally engaged in the car chase. And that's kind of what this film is for me. But what are your thoughts on Gone in 60 Seconds?
Producer, director, and star. I think that says it all.
Yeah.
You should hire someone to write it.
Yes.
Yeah, someone good to write it, because like you could have had a really good story here, you know, I would have loved to have seen him get into the backgrounds of the people there who were stealing the cars.
Yes.
You know, I think that would have been really cool. You know, you can see what his motivations were and everything like that. But it's just, you know, no, they're here. They're just stealing cars. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that's what I thought was really weak about it. And, that's what the part that I thought. Like, you know, having the producer, director, and star all in one kind of seems a little bit one-sided, kind of weak, you know? Is what I thought about that. Mm-hmm. But what I did like about it was the chase scene went on way too long, for starters. But it did show the destruction and the harm caused by it. So it wasn't look how we got away. No. You know, look what was left behind.
Yes.
And they did a good job of doing that. You know, you saw a lot of time where the people are there, you know, the ones that he crashed into and whatnot, you see them in their cars and they're bleeding and stuff. I thought that was cool.
Yeah, lots of injuries, yeah.
Yeah, they were showing you that, you know, showing you everything like that. That's what I thought. And I thought about the strong part of the movie, actually.
Yeah, he must have had a good second unit for that, because, like, he's still driving, right? But then somebody else had to kind of follow along and, like, take care of that part of it, so.
Yeah, I thought that was a good part when you did that, you know, because a lot of times, you know, you don't see anybody else getting hurt. Like even nowadays when they're showing it too, you know, guys are flipping cars and everything like that, yet nobody gets hurt on the outside, you know?
Yeah.
And there's no innocent bystanders ever getting it. This is what I thought. Whereas here they showed you, look, this is the innocent bystander. Look at all the harm this is causing, you know? Look at some of the cars that he's wrecked.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was good. But other than that, I didn't see a lot in it either. I thought it needed, you know, it needed more development in the characters. It needed more development in the story. That's what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it could have been really good. And thank God it wasn't a Nicolas Cage one.
Well, that one had a screenplay and a screenwriter and all the production values and everything there. But
yeah, but it had Nicolas Cage. What can I
and
say?
It had a, and it had a super, like, a giant budget. This had nothing. So, the reason you would see producer, director, star, like everything is done by the same person is because you can't afford to pay all of them. And your cost alone and like the number of cars that got damaged in this film, like added up and like really nice cars too. Like how much money did it cost to damage all of these vehicles and including the one, I mean, that he's driving around and like the stunt vehicle and everything, so they could go through all that. I mean, I'm sure it was totally independent and just friends getting together and making this film. And, I don't know if the one you saw had an introduction by his widow or whatever. And so she's talking about what he was like. And then, they had a little bit of a thing afterwards, about it, but it was a lot of work to do this. And obviously he's interested in cars. He's interested in car thieves. He's interested in driving fast in a major city. So on that basis, I think it's successful, but as a movie, or like you mentioned, like, okay, they're having shots of like the damage is caused by all this, which we don't see in action movies, Bad Boys 2, where they go destroy an entire shanty town and we don't care. We're just moving our heroes move on with the story. But what do you think he's trying to say about, you know, car chases or robberies or that by showing that? Like, is it worth it for people to get injured so he can make a movie, or for people who steal cars and they're running away from the cops and then anybody else who gets in the way, the innocent bystanders? What do you think is being said with those follow-up shots?
I think it's showing you, like, you know, there's more to it than there's more crime than just the stolen car.
Okay.
You know, like, that's what I think. There's a lot
do you
more.
Think it, do you think it's an anti-crime message that this movie has?
Oh, definitely. I thought it was anti-crime right off the bat. No doubt about it.
Okay.
Or, just could happen. Like, you know, they steal the car and there's heroin in it, right? Like,
That was one of the big catalysts here for this, that they're, you know, they got this and then they've, you know, any one of these situations where they come into drugs and then they're going to try to, you know, sell it or profit from it is not going to be a good thing. But I think, you know, are there people who would watch this movie and think, wow, it's really cool to drive super fast and have the cops chase me and get all these adventures? Like, is that?
No, I think it just goes the opposite of that one.
You think it does? It steers people away from driving. It steers people bad.
Yeah, it's all because of that destruction it shows. I think it's, you know, I think it turns people, you know, away from that, I think.
Okay. Because I feel like there's some people who like watch this and like the much more, I think like Bullet is considered to have the best car chase scene in film history for a reason. And it has a great story and actors and Steve McQueen and all that around it. But I think there is something in those, any of those car chase sequence in action movies that it does rev up. I talked about watching the remake and then being 20 some years old and pulling out of, you know, my spot in downtown Saskatoon and like driving a little bit faster than I normally would, cause I'm all energized by that, which is completely missing the point of what this is saying here. So I wasn't sure if it was a little bit more about like, I look at what I can do to make a film, look at what kind of a driver I am, or is this a vanity project, or is this trying to send a message? I'm still a little bit unclear on that, which doesn't mean I'm not impressed with what this guy managed to do, because, you know, I don't know anybody else outside of O.J. Simpson's friend who can cause this kind of a car chase happening in Los Angeles and being able to get away with it. Because I think now they would get the guy early on. I think this is kind of what's interesting is movies like this led into Speed, where you have the bus and you have to keep driving that fast all through all the obstacles of Los Angeles and any major city where it's tough to move fast and move around here. I mean, I think that's that like the action movies really do owe something to this film, but whether it's a great movie, I don't know. I think it's an entertaining movie and it's a good movie and it's, you know, a bit of a thumbs up. I'm not as enthused by it as I might be about the other movies, but it's interesting what he did there. So, yeah.
Vanishing Point had one of the best car chases I've seen. Have you seen a movie called Vanishing Point?
Vanishing Point is one of the, yeah, that's cited in there with Gone in 60 Seconds.
Yeah, one of the car chase movies. But that doesn't have any of the
Dirty Larry, Crazy Mary, or Crazy Mary, Dirty Larry. That Peter Fonda one as well, and Ride with the Devil. Like those ones are all these great '70s, great '70s car chase movies. And again, Tarantino was aware of them when he put Death Proof together to try to bring, which is part of the Grindhouse film, to try to bring this idea or this subgenre a film back. It didn't completely do that, but almost every action movie that you watch has to have an elaborate car chase scene now, and it kind of goes back to these movies from the 70s.
Yeah, I thought it's a little bit sexist to the most of these car movies, because they always have female names, the cars.
Yeah.
You know, something you ride has a female name all the time. I don't know about that.
Yeah, I do sense that. I'm not as familiar with that world, but I think that's been a thing. And I think among like motorcycle gangs and that kind of thing too. Don't they often name their bikes or their hogs after women?
Yeah,
yeah.
Same thing. That's the only thing I thought about it.
Yeah, but again, like it's again that kind of 2026 thinking, and this is early 70s. I mean, that's but it is a fact for sure. So anything else you'd like to say about Gone in 60 Seconds?
No, like I said, I'm just glad it wasn't a...
glad Nicolas Cage didn't show up.
No, I just can't stand that guy, man.
Baby Nicolas Cage in one scene watching on. So.
Like, I don't know whether he went a best actor. Like, give me a break.
A conversation for another day.
Want to come on inside and have a drink?
No, thank you.
You sure? We got time.
No, thank you, ma'am.
You got a problem?
Lady, after a while, a fella learns things. Some women are trouble.
Suit yourself.
I'll always do.
Carl, thanks so much for being on the Shelf Shedding Movie Show again, for talking about these four 70s crime movies. Of course, this is along the lines of every 10 episodes. It doesn't always work out if I have specialized episodes, but every 10 episodes I have to have a double elimination. In the case of this movie, this episode, we're doing four movies, so two of the movies have to leave my collection after we do the points there. But just first off, thanks so much for coming back on the show. I appreciate all your time on this.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. It was enjoyed the conversation.
Again, yeah, hopefully it won't be as long a time between episodes as we had before here. So we're going to go in the order that we watch them in. So as far as like your ranking there of the films, starting off with Frenzy, how many points would you give Frenzy?
Strong four.
Four. Yeah, I could tell you really like that movie.
Hands down, yeah, hands down, strong four.
Yeah, awesome. I think I know what the next one is, but Sorcerer.
That, I'm sorry, that one's got the 9-tit one.
one. Yeah, that one wasn't as enjoyable for you.
Mm-hmm.
The Outfit.
That got the three. Got loved three. It. Yeah.
Then that would mean Gone 60 Seconds got two. Perfect.
Yeah, that's where I'm at.
Yeah, I mean, there's some things where we're quite similar, and then there's some areas where we are significantly different. Frenzy, I actually ended up doing a tie between a couple movies. So Frenzy got 2.5 points for me. I felt kind of the age of it a little bit. I still feel like at some points Hitchcock did his thing with this, but I maybe prefer some of his earlier stuff, but I still think it's like a solid London serial killer movie that he did with a lot of, again, you mentioned like the psychological aspects of it and the accuracy of having a serial killer. Serial killers, like, are often very charming people, and that's what we see with our killer, but has a bunch of other stuff going on that we see later on. I had a couple issues, I think, with the acting going a little bit too big. Once we know who the killer is, and suddenly the killer starts acting super evil. Again, that's a factor in this type of a movie in a lot of them. I like Sorcerer a lot more than you do. It was actually 4 points for me. I'm glad I revisited it. I didn't mind the middle because I felt I got into the story and I felt like I was like with those guys, as horrible as they are. And you find yourself in this conflicting position of you're cheering for their survival, yet you're recognizing they're horrible. But really, there's nobody in this film to cheer for, which is kind of the tricky thing there. But so my best was your worst there. The Outfit I gave 2.5 to. I was part of my impulse was to give it more credit than Frenzy, but I think there's a couple of the independent pieces to it, production stuff, that, you know, it may be a little bit of an easier story to be able to, you know, from A to B to get to, as opposed to Frenzy has a lot of other subtleties to it. And just the difference in the directing of having Hitchcock as a director for The Outfit, but the performances in The Outfit and the setting of it, and like, I like these kind of revenge crime films, was excellent. So 2.5 points for The Outfit. Sadly, 1 point for Gone in 60 Seconds. And it's not, the first time I saw it, I thought it might be a one and I wouldn't like it at all. I've grown to appreciate what this guy achieved with the money he had and putting friends and family together into this movie, including that wedding scene. I think that wedding scene at the beginning, there was actually an actual family wedding happening that they were shooting around. All that to say, I think, you know, we talked about at the beginning, character development and story is so important. And I think we didn't get a whole lot of character, but we got the setup and we got the kind of the main action to it, but it's not as much of a story. They needed, you're right, needed a bit of a screenwriter or somebody who could kind of shape it a little bit more. And again, just using voice post-production audio and voiceover to fill in the scenes that you didn't have the money to capture or whatever, made it look a little bit too low budget for me, I guess. But I wouldn't dissuade anybody from seeing any of these movies. Mm-hmm. Due to that, the points thing kind of worked out that Frenzy ended up being our number one movie with 6.5 points. The Outfit got 5.5, and it was second. So the two movies that have to leave my collection, third place went to Sorcerer, got 5 points, mostly because of my 4 points there, and Gone in 60 Seconds. I do own physical copies of both of these movies, so they have to leave my collection. So, Carl, you get to decide what I do with those movies.
Put them on eBay.
Put them on eBay?
Sure.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
I've been on eBay before, so but I'll put them on eBay and see what comes of it. Yeah. Sounds good. I think, you know, a couple of them are, it's certainly Gone in 60 Seconds. I think that one's a little bit more rare. Sorcerers, they had a couple of discs out and Criterion. It's not, I don't have a Criterion, but the Criterion came up with it recently too. So it's a movie that movie geeks are thinking about right now. Thanks again for being on the show. I just want to mention some other friendly podcasts for us. A Lifetime of Hallmark, Kurt Fitzpatrick, Les Kirkendall Barrett. And I also want to mention Schlock and Awe, Lindsay Wilkins' podcast, as well as Oscar So Random, her other podcast about the Oscars. And, of course, Larry Parsons' show, Rank and Review. All great friends of the Shelf Shedding Movie Show, guests on this show. I've been guests on their shows, and look forward to doing more of that in the future. And again, thanks, Carl. And as I say at the end of every show, just be kind to one another, be safe, keep supporting the movies. And until next time, talk to you later.